Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Intel's big little CPUs and a new irreparable boot flaw. Amazon just walk out, sad news on Android software updates, some help finding new desktop speakers, and so much coronavirus drama. It's all coming up next on Twitch. This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Using the same password everywhere is a security nightmare waiting to happen. LastPass easily creates unique passwords for every site. Visit lastpass.com/twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit's This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 557, recorded on March 12th, 2020. Some sound advice for your desktop. Welcome to Twit's This Week in Computer Hardware, Twit's weekly show that's all about the hardware and occasionally about the coronavirus. But this week, we're going to talk about processors and coronavirus. I don't know what to tell you. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Sebastian Peek, editor-in-chief, PCPer.com. Sebastian, how are you holding up? Have you quarantined yet? Are you feeling the... Actually, I shouldn't say that because people think that you've been exposed to the coronavirus, but as far as we know, neither of us have.
As little as I leave my house, it's highly unlikely. Though I am...
He's going to live forever.
I'm living in constant fear because I am one of those people who is married to somebody who works in a hospital. And so every day when she comes home, I'm like, you better scrub down. I don't want to see you. Don't touch our son. And so you go into the bathroom and wash for like 10 minutes because I'm a little obsessive, but I also don't leave very much. So
I was going to say, he's not a shut-in. He's just at home a lot.
That's such a harsh term, shut-in. It's kind of like calling me an entitled millennial, which I can't imagine anyone ever doing, Patrick.
No, I called you a millennial, but just because I wanted to watch your facial expression. I also mocked your flavor of jazz.
There were some other words.
Which is also my flavor of jazz. But
listening to certain obscure, pretentious jazz selections on your, you know, whatever you said. But we'll let it slide. Clearly, it didn't upset me at all.
Yeah, as somebody who owns like 32 Coltrane albums, I have no room to throw any shade in that general direction.
I can't help myself. Sorry to interrupt. I can't help myself. I shouldn't say this, but I'm not a huge Coltrane fan because he's a little mainstream for me. Not that this makes me a millennial at all. I listened to Coltrane a lot when I was 12, but I've moved on. So
you've moved on to more sophisticated things. So
I'm
if
more of a
you're
Wayne
wondering
Shorter guy, but hey, you know.
What this digression is about, I'm mostly a ska and punk rock guy, but that's neither here nor there. I was torturing Sebastian in pre-show for the sheer unbridled joy of it, and he's taking his revenge on me now, as well he should. Speaking of revenge, there's no doubt that Intel still owns the vast majority of the mobile and the desktop market, but of course, AMD's been making gains, which has led to all sorts of insanity, all sorts of efforts, I will call it, since apparently I'm in a feisty, ticking people off mood today, as Sebastian will report. But you just wrote up an article on Intel's 10-nanometer Adler Lake S CPUs. Up to 16 big dot little cores, and hopefully PCI Express 4.0. What's going on with this? This will actually be the first 10-nanometer desktop CPU from Intel, a new socket, because really, if Intel can learn anything from AMD, it's that they should continue changing sockets as often as possible. And now I am getting kind of snarky. Video Cards was talking about possible big dot little configurations for Alder Lake S processors. And as many as 16 cores. Is this rumor? Is this verified? Is this madness? How does this pass or not pass the sniff test?
It seems a little fantastic. It's rumor, first of all. They've not confirmed any of this, and I don't have any more concrete sources than Video Cards. This originally came from some Chinese forums where there was apparently or reportedly a leaked slide that showed this Alder Lake S product with its unusual configuration. Now, there's also another 10-nanometer product, Comet Lake S. And there's been speculation that they were going to be moving to an LGA 1200 socket. Currently, the 11.5X stuff is what we have for desktop. And so that was going to be a bit of a change. This is LGA 1700, which seems – the whole thing seems kind of fantastic. But what's really fascinating about it is the slide shows three different configurations, and it tops out at an 8 plus 8 plus 1 configuration. Now, this is apparently big little, so 8 plus 8 would be 8 big cores, 8 low power cores, and then the plus 1 is graphics. So in this case, Intel's GT1, which is their lower tier graphics. They have GT1, GT2, and GT3. So lower number of execution units, kind of your basic Intel HD graphics. But 8 plus 8 is, it's weird. Now, big little, for those who don't know, it's an ARM thing. ARM is the mobile processor, basically the template of everything that we use. And for this configuration, it would basically be eight full power x86 Intel cores, whatever the Skylake derivative is, or obviously this is a newer generation. This is 10 nanometer architecture, so it would not be Skylake derivative, like Comet Lake derivative. I'm not sure exactly what the architecture of Alder Lake is, but these eight smaller cores, I'm not sure what that would be. If this is some more of like an Atom style processor, something very low power and meant for those kind of background tasks and processes that don't need your big cores. But it's kind of fascinating to look at this, especially considering the TDPs. At first I was thinking, oh, this is going to be a mobile part. Kind of makes sense. Like we've heard rumors, we talked about this, I think last week, about Apple potentially going to an ARM-based solution, one of their in-house processor designs for Macs in the future. Well, it seems to make sense that Intel might pursue the same thing, especially if they want to keep Apple a client. If Apple wants to move in a mobile direction and they have a mobile product, that kind of makes sense. But this is something that would be completely unique within the PC industry if there's an x86-based big little design like this. Do you have any thoughts about this, Patrick? Does this sound rational at all to you?
You know, it's the word peculiar comes to mind for no particularly interesting reason. The first thing I thought was the reaction I have every time I see PCI Express 4.0, especially when Ryzen launched with it, is that yay! And then I remember that nobody can saturate like the 32 gigabits or gigabytes per second on gigabytes per gigabits. Nobody can saturate like PCI 3.0 in terms of its 32 gigabytes per second when you're looking at X16. The theoretical 64 gigabytes per second isn't particularly useful. And then they were only hitting 70% of that. And then some manufacturers were actually capping it to behave like PCI Express 3.0. That was my first reaction was being like, eh. My second reaction was actually start thinking about this. And, you know, as you kind of noted, it's the TDPs kind of make you blink a little bit. 125 watt, 150 watt, that's like, 9200 series processor.
Yeah.
Maybe not, they're not idling at 150 watts, but they start sounding like, big power sucking parts again. And I kind of got stuck there. I get why ARM did this on processors for phones. Wonder. I don't know. I guess to think less and speak more. It seems like, well, it once again seems like they're looking at battery life being the primary thing they have to move forward on the mobile platform, which makes sense given that they basically doubled GPU performance but did nothing particularly useful in terms of CPU performance in the last generation processor. And now it looks like the next generation processor or the generation next processor may deliver increased battery life along with increased GPU performance, but still not doing much in terms of overall power user performance on laptops, which is somebody who spends a lot of time dealing with video on laptops is really frustrating. But in terms of the vast majority of the people who consume Intel laptops is probably exactly what they're looking for.
You know, I just thought of something. What if this slide, which obviously is, I would assume has been recreated, or it does not.
Right.
There's just something about it. It looks a little bit fabricated. It might have been just created because this is from a translated leak. But the thing that strikes me about this is, because this seems like such a mobile focused part, if it's a real part, what if there's just a missing decimal point here? What if this is 8.0 watts, like 8 watts and then 12.5 configurable up to 15? That makes a lot more sense for this.
Yeah. That becomes kind of whoa.
Yeah. Like 16 cores low power seems crazy, but if you think, well, it's eight low power cores and then eight of what essentially are mobile cores, and you remember, you know, 2014 is when I think it was Merrifield, Intel's mobile platform for phones was out. So that was the last iteration of that, and they've gotten out of that market, but they have this technology, and that was based on 22 nanometer architecture. So if they've scaled this down to 10 nanometer, that could be, I mean, that was like quad core parts in mobile, possibly up to 8 cores. I don't remember the configurations that were available, but those were ultra low TDP mobile parts. Scale those up to a laptop and pair them up with some traditional laptop cores, and it would be compelling. And like you're talking about battery life, that's where they need to be. They need higher core counts, especially to compete with AMD, who now has all of a sudden with the Ryzen 4000 mobile parts, very high mobile core counts, like 8 and 16 thread parts for laptops. So
starts getting kind of interesting.
Yeah. And who knows? If this is simply a matter of loss in translation and these TDPs were completely out of whack, then this starts to look like a mobile part. But for desktop, it just doesn't make any sense. I don't see why they wouldn't pursue something to compete with like the 3900 and 3950X for desktop. Because we're still, you can spend $500 right now on an Intel CPU and it's still an 8-core CPU. The 9900K and KS are 8-core 16-thread parts. And for around the same price or even a little bit less, you can buy a 16-core 32-thread part from AMD. So you'd think, when the desktop parts hit, they'd be focusing maybe a little bit more on high core count to compete. But, you know, like you said, that their niche is basically mobile.
Right.
Enthusiast desktop right now is all AMD. Not all, but it's all about AMD. The majority of the coverage, enthusiasm, and it seems purchasing is being made around the Ryzen 3000 series. So they dominate laptops, though. Still, even with older
architectures, is where the majority of system sales are. Well, let's pause this. We're going to see whether or not anything else flies out of the rumor mill, or whether Intel makes any announcements, or if any additional supporting evidence shows up in the none too distant future. We mentioned in the opening coronavirus because obviously it is a huge thing right now. And I'll take stating the obvious for 1,000, Alex. E3 has been canceled. The NAB show, which you were probably less familiar with, E3, which is the show in the video gaming world, has been canceled. National Association of Broadcasters has canceled NAB. I want to say AXPONA, which is an audio, a high-end audio festival, has been canceled. You know, obviously, the president announced that he was shutting down travel from Europe. There has been a shutdown of travel in China. Foxconn's manufacturing is back online in China. The founder noted in an interview with Reuters that he has, quote, concerns, unquote, over the electronic supply chain, not to mention consumer demand. But Foxconn is back in selling... selling manufacturing phones and laptops. You noticed that NVIDIA canceled their plans for a remote keynote.
Yeah.
Is it, you know. classic GDC, travel boondoggle gets canceled.
Well, I don't know, because it's weird, because they were originally going to have, like, obviously the Game Developers Conference was canceled. GDC was canceled. So then they were going to move it to a remote event, which they are. And they've opened up registration. Anybody can register now and have access to all the stuff. NVIDIA, of course, is the big keynote speaker, and they typically announce new products there. And we've been waiting for Ampere, the new graphics products, potentially. We don't know for sure. But they were the virtual keynote, the live stream keynote, which was to replace the in-person keynote, has also been canceled. They were still citing coronavirus as the reason. So I'm not sure exactly what goes into these keynotes with NVIDIA that they would not be able to do it. But I guess it makes sense. Like, anyway, it's being replaced with just a simple press release, and then they're going to have an investor call. So I've not been pre-briefed on that or anything. I'm going to find out, probably when everybody else does, what, if any, new products they have to announce. And then that will, of course, be revealed on the investor call. But that's coming up towards the end of the month. I think it was like the 24th of May or March that they were going to have this call. So if there's new GPUs to announce, which I kind of doubt at this point, I almost wonder if there wasn't a big push to still have the keynote because maybe because of supply chain concerns, they don't have anything quite yet. Maybe a delay is to blame, but they're, I can't help but think, and we were talking about this last night here, that whenever Navi, big Navi, is announced, you'd better believe there's going to be an NVIDIA announcement too. They've been either right on the heels of or actually preceding. Seems like they get their information just a little bit before the public does. Just like back last year when Navi was first coming out, the Radeon 5700 series launched on July 7th. And the NVIDIA Super Series launched on July 2nd, 5 days earlier. So they knew it was coming. They jumped it. And the rest is history. So we'll see. I'm just sore about E3. Not that I was going to get anything tangible. I don't think Sony was going to do anything about PlayStation there, obviously. They do their own thing. So the endless speculation about what is going to be in the next generation consoles, I guess we'll have to, you know, it'll be coming from different directions, and we don't have E3 to endlessly speculate about there.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Mobile World Congress is shut down, E3 is shut down, NAB is shut down. It's just a huge number of really important shows, or traditionally really important shows, including Google I.O. It was interesting because 9to5Mac did a nice article on the Google Pixel 4a leak and how it was confirming a $399 price tag. I guess because all over town there were billboards showing a next-generation Google phone. I don't know if we can get the link up to that, the 95google.com link. I was also laughing. You know, quote, the billboard design shots are clearly not real images, but rather photoshopped onto a real-life photograph to illustrate what the design would look like in real life. This being an article by Ben Schoon over at 9to5Google. But we'll talk about the Pixel 4a leaks and the first video and the first online sale of the Pixel 4a in a minute. I also want to give a shout to Apple and Amazon. Amazon particularly being notorious for driving the snot, especially out of its warehouse employees, fulfillment center employees. But Apple and Amazon are both looking at giving, in the case of Apple, their retail workers are getting unlimited sick leave if they're showing coronavirus-like systems, which I think is rather thoughtful of them to do, given that standing in a room waiting for people to show up and touching things that they've touched is a kind of a nightmare in a pandemic or epidemic situation. That Amazon's not going to be, CNBC writes that Amazon won't be docking warehouse workers if they're missing shifts during the coronavirus crisis. And given how tightly they manage their employees, that's kind of a big deal for Amazon and surprisingly human of them for their fulfillment centers, which I think is a good thing. Shifting gears into another cheerful direction. There's yet another security vulnerability being reported on Intel. And this one is an irreparable boot flaw, which sounds terrifying, comma.
Yes.
Should we be terrified? Question mark.
It's terrifying to think when it's being framed as like it cannot be fixed. It's irreparable. Sounds really bad.
Right.
And this is something that I don't think many people know. There's something called, and I had to look up what this stands for, the CSME, Intel's Converged Security and Management Engine. So it's actually a little processor. It's a 32-bit processor on the board that mm-hmm. runs. It has its own SRAM, has its own ROM, and it runs its own OS. And so I almost wonder if this could be patched, since it actually has. Well, the ROM, I guess, cannot be. But anyway, it runs even when your system is off, as long as your system is powered. And mm-hmm. the vulnerability affects this because of the design of the CSME. It's vulnerable to exploitation at boot, like during the boot process. So platform integrity is under question here, but I imagine this would require the malicious code to be local. It's fascinating, though. I mean, CSME, like, I'm looking at the article now. It looks like it has been patched before. Though, quote, it looks as if the measures required to secure a system are in a different league than before, end quote. Ooh. So we will see. I mean, this is one of those things where I'm waiting for, like, the official Intel response. The closing paragraph includes this line, though. The only method of securing their system is to upgrade to 10th generation Intel CPUs. 10th generation Intel, if it ever comes to desktop, it's already on mobile. They are not susceptible to this. It's only 9th generation of before. So 10th generation is one way. So either upgrade to 10th generation, motherboards and CPUs, or go back 10 years to a legacy platform that was in place before Intel integrated CSME, or switch to AMD. Those are your three options. So I'm sure Intel would love to sell you 10th gen on desktop if that was an option right now. But the vulnerability is like in there. It's baked in.
So this is also one of those cases where, you know, it's a reminder that physical security is important, which is not exactly a new story. But, you know, if you can't physically secure your items, it's one more thing to worry about. Speaking of which, Elvia attack? Or LVI hijack?
Yes, LVI.
Pardon me. It's LVI attack.eu, the LVI hijacking transient execution with load value injection.
Just think about all the previous ones. Yeah, it's another layer. Right. It's the same basic thing. It's related to what we've already seen, like zombie load meltdown, and it's the only way to really secure yourself against these would be to disable any kind of speculative execution, disable symmetrical multi-threading. So, you know, disable hyper-threading and basically make your processor as slow as an old school Pentium. If you were to turn off all speculative,
just go back to Pentium and you'll be fine.
Yeah, you'll be fine. Legacy platforms are safest and best. Obviously, running a 486 might inconvenience some if you like things like, you know, the modern internet. But it's turns out that it's a lot safer to be on a very old platform, especially if it's not connected to the internet. But that's another story. But yeah, this is
just air gap your machine, lock it in concrete, and go start manually doing everything.
If your system is swimming with the fishes, then it's fine. It's safe as long as it's out of commission. The bad thing about this, the load value injection, right, or LVI, is that it apparently, quote, defeats all existing mitigations. So the part that concerns me isn't that it's not going to be,
right.
I think I just use a double negative. I'm not sure even what I'm saying at this point. It's not that it is not going to be patched. It's that they are saying, the actual researcher's website, this LVIattack.eu site, is saying that it cannot be transparently mitigated in existing processors and necessitates expensive software patches, expensive to performance, of course, which may slow down Intel SGX Enclave computations to up to 19 times. So 2x to 19x for those operations. So it could have a bigger impact than previous mitigations is what I'm trying to say. It won't be like, oh, 2-3%. Maybe it'll be more because we've reached an aggregate. I know we talked a while back about like the Phoronix testing about pre-mitigation, post-mitigation server-side workloads. And it was up to, I think, about 12% by that time. So you add this to the mix, and it's going to be even slower.
Well, the only thing to do is obviously is to buy a new processor.
let me buy that 10th gen Intel desktop processor real quick. For some reason, I can't find one for sale.
Yeah, that's probably hurting them too. The, part of what's interesting about this is they're basically implying that, anything in excess is memory has the possibility of being able to exploit this. It can affect virtually any access to memory. I just every time I read that, inject the attacking data or attacker's data through hidden processor buffers into a victim program and hijack transient execution to acquire sensitive information such as the victim's fingerprints or passwords. It's a dense article, I will say, even by the standard of dense security articles. It's a thick read.
Yes.
How likely it is to impact any end user is quite frankly something I've had difficulty coming out there. Well, more on this as it evolves.
Indeed.
Which seems to be the theme of this episode.
I was going to say, for end users, the only thing that really matters is if your inevitable software and BIOS updates come down and significantly impact performance, it'll be a problem. And if it doesn't, it won't be a problem, and everything will be fine. It'll all be patched.
Oh, my goodness. A good place to find out more information about this would probably be the super best, awesome, excellent, most fine security podcast here on the Twit Network, Security Now, which is hosted by Steve Gibson and Leo Laporte. They are covering every major hack, virus, vulnerability, and bug out there. I suspect Steve has read this article and is not staring at it going, my brain hurts, but thinking about what this actually means to the average end user or for the average corporate administrator. Steve knows what he's talking about, right? He coined the term spyware. He created the first anti-spyware program, plus SpinRite, Shields Up, and Squirrel. If you're not familiar with Security Now, it gets recorded every Tuesday. So to stay up to date on all things internet security, subscribe to Security Now on your favorite podcatcher, or you can head over to twit.tv/SN. to subscribe. And that's Security Now with Steve Gibson and Leo Laporte. We want to thank you for checking them out. And of course, thank you for tuning into our podcast and hopefully subscribing. Have you had a chance to experience one of the Amazon Go stores, Sebastian?
No, I have not. I don't think there are any around here.
I didn't think so, but I wanted to ask. There are a couple in San Francisco. I got to go into one because I was doing some work near one for a couple days. And you kind of like have the app, you scan your phone, and then it automatically knows whatever you pick up off the shelves and charges you for them. And I was just fascinated that they are actually going to be marketing that technology, the Just Walk Out technology, which is one of the weirder names I've ever heard of. I just wanted to mention that basically you'll insert a credit card into a turnstile. Instead of scanning an app, you'll insert your credit card. There'll be a little bit of Amazon Go branding. Everything else is like the supermarket or the Target or whatever it is, whatever kind of store is going to adopt this. And if it scales, because these stores that Amazon does, the Amazon Go stores, they're fairly small and they have a fairly limited number of items inside of them. I'm really kind of curious to see if this works for other environments, because literally the idea is that you could walk into your big box store, your supermarket, whatever it is, throw what you need into a cart, you know, scan your credit card, you know, go in there, throw what you need in a cart, and then just roll out without standing in line. And if you've ever been in a Home Depot on a Saturday or, you know, any other store on the planet, you can see why this might be attractive. I'm curious to see whether or not this is going to happen. There's a nice article on Reuters that talks about this. And one of the things that came out of that for me was that there's a couple of competitors, Grab and Go and AFI. And so there's also an interesting observation that they point out is that a lot of retailers hate Amazon and would never buy an incredibly useful technology from Amazon just because they don't want to support Amazon. It's interesting. I've also never had anything that resembled an adequate explanation of how it does what it does. So I'm very, very curious to see if at some point we find out what it requires to actually make everything work on this, or basically how it tracks the crap you threw in your bag or your cart rather than everybody else's. So,
yeah, I would assume the radio frequency stuff would be part of it.
Yeah.
I remember I used to work in retail and I remember hearing about the technology that went into working with companies on packaging because they wanted to integrate right. this into packaging. So it was part of the UPC.
Shrinkage control.
Right. Exactly. So the behind the UPC of every product, there would be one of these little pads that would have, I can't remember the actual term, but like a its own signal, a unique signal. So if they have something on the shelf, identifying that it's been picked up and then which unique identifier that is. And it's just, it's kind of crazy. But I will say it sounds ultra convenient for me as a prospective credit card thief to be able to walk into a shop like that, scan the stolen credit card, go in. And I don't know about you, but I don't like waiting in line when I'm trying to buy a cart full of things that I'm using a stolen credit card to purchase. So I think it'll make it very easy and straightforward. But yeah, it makes me very nervous to think that I could lose a card and then, oh wow, an entire shopping basket of stuff was just purchased on my account.
Well, generally speaking, as long as there's self-checkout, it's pretty easy to do that anyway.
It is, so. That's true. And everything around here has had self-checkout for, I don't know, almost 20 years now.
I was going to say approximately forever. Yeah. New MacBook Pro and MacBook Air models with scissors keyboards launching in the second quarter, which might explain why they were ramping things up at Foxconn. That's the rumor from Ming-Chi Kuo, which was published in Mac Rumors. We've talked about rumors about 14 and 16-inch MacBook Pros. Or I should say 14-inch model. The 16-inch MacBook Pro came out not too long ago. Not much to comment about that otherwise, although quote believes that operations at MacBook related suppliers will improve significantly starting in late March, paving the way for mass production of new MacBook Pro and MacBook Air models. And that's Joe Rosendahl writing for Mac Rumor. So if you're waiting for a new MacBook, MacBook Air, MacBook Pro, you might want to wait until April, give or take. I just wanted to point out something that really I thought was irritating. A couple of the reviews on the Samsung S20 have pointed out that software updates are only going to be guaranteed for 2 years. So
Ooh.
You have a 20 more month flagship. That was very graciously put. And then we mentioned the Pixel 4a video leaks. So with the Pixel 4, it was like a box of pixels fell off of a truck and they were selling them out of the Ukraine. This time it's a box of pixels fell off the back of a truck and are being sold by a Cuban store. Android Police is the write-up. First Pixel 4i video leak reveals Snapdragon 7 36 gigabytes of RAM and a 3,080 milliamp hour battery. 6 gigs of RAM and a $400 phone is not a bad deal, and the 730 is pretty solid. I'm also laughing because they use the fell off a truck metaphor also.
Yeah.
So, Cuban technology blog Tecnolike Plus has released a 6.5 minute long Spanish overview of the yet to be released phone. So, props to Manuel Vonau over at Android Police for that one. It's a good looking phone. If this is the phone, it's looking very, very nice. So, we will wait to find out what's going on with that. Google I/O, of course, being canceled, as we mentioned earlier. Has slowed down the whole process of Google-related news this spring. Owen writes from Australia. Love the podcast. Longtime listener. First-time emailer. I'm hoping for some sound advice. Ha-ha. Get it. On options for my new computer. Currently uses a set of old Altec Lansing VS4121 speakers. Half music, half gaming. They're dead. He's got a 13 by 16 foot room, and he's looking to upgrade his speakers, or basically not upgrade, replace his dead speakers, and he wants to upgrade his Audio-Technica ADH-8900s. He's looking for something like the Biodynamic Amaron or the DT990s, quote, as they get used a lot more now that I have a young family. You can understand that. My question is, if I bought a set of Audio Engine HD3 speakers, would the audio jack as part of the speaker do justice to a new set of Biodynamics, or should I buy a shit audio hell as well as the speakers? If I was not to buy the powered speakers and a headphone app, would I be better off getting an amplifier like an Onkyo 9019 or a Cambridge Audio AXA35 and passive speakers? I'm open to suggestions on amps and passive speakers too. I've got about $400, $600 to spend plus $300 on headphones. So it's got a pretty healthy budget. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this and general comments around PC speaker setups in an upcoming podcast. Kind regards, Owen. I've used desktop speakers and standalone amplifiers on my desktop for years now. I've used the Kef Eggs. I'm a huge fan of powered speakers. That article, that you, if you're watching the video, you just saw a Wirecutter article pop up for a second. And that is a really good discussion of what you should get for computer speakers. And assuming you are not, you do not object to having big speakers on your desktop, there are some really good self-powered speakers that are available out there. And the ones they chose for their pick, the Mackie CR4BT. Now, I don't know what you have for chains of music stores in Australia, but there's like Guitar Center is one where they have locations all over the United States. And they have a lot of, you know, what they call studio monitors, which is a speaker with a built-in amplifier. In some cases now, like these Mackies, they include like Bluetooth or USB input. And it gives you this big, healthy, self-contained set of speakers that eliminates you from having to deal with things like buying a separate amplifier and speakers. You know, I've used some of ELAC speakers we've talked about. I've used my old, you know, B&W speakers. Any desktop speaker, especially if you're a gamer or if you like your EDM to have thump combined with a subwoofer, is fantastic. I would say if these are available by you, they would be worth checking out. They are also fans of the Audio Engine HD3. I have not heard those, so I don't have a real opinion of them at this point. But I will say, if you have a small family or a young family, you're looking to save money, you know, any type of receiver or the Onkyo you mentioned combined with a set of desktops or a set of bookshelf speakers will often spank just about anything else that it's available. Those Mackies are pretty good. JBL does some good desktop monitors. And those are convenient because you don't have to deal with a separate amplifier to go with your speakers. Although I found that a separate amplifier under my monitor elevated my monitor to a better height. So, you know, your mileage is going to vary. I would just make sure if you bought a set of standalone speakers like that or monitors that they offer either a subwoofer output or that you can split the signal coming off the back of your sound card to input to the speakers. The Shit Hell is a good headphone amplifier, the Objective 2, which is a slightly aging open source design that may or may not be available from an Australian vendor, is nice. The USB headphone amplifiers, the Dragonflies from AudioQuest are excellent values for the money, especially if you can find one of the older ones. You know, there's lots of good options out there. I will also say the audio outputs on motherboard these days, motherboards are vastly better than they were 5-10 years ago. And that may be a good place to start. The headphones, my only concern, and I know you probably have something to add here, Sebastian, is that open-backed headphones like those DT990s or the Ambio can be really unpleasant if you're trying to separate your sound from the rest of the family. Or if there's, you know, you're playing video games where there might be any, you know, squelching, blasting, destroying, screaming sounds that you don't want to have to explain to, say, perhaps a three-year-old. A friend of mine had an amazing story about scaring the snot out of one of his smaller children with these sounds that were leaking out the backs of his open headphones, which he was admittedly playing at a ridiculously high level. You know, so I might choose the DT990s, they're a legendary headphone from Biodynamic. I might choose the DT770 instead because they're sealed. And also, they're kind of a studio grade headphone. They're not very fancy looking, but they're super comfortable. And you can pretty much drive rebar into the ground with them. They are just overbuilt, and it will be hard for your children to kill them, much like the Sony MDR7506. So that may be something to consider. If you're worried about your kids, your young family tearing into your headphone collection and wreaking havoc.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand that open backs. I prefer open back headphones myself, but open backs, obviously they leak, and some leak more than others. And some of them, it seems like a small speaker in the room. You can't believe how loud they are.
A small to the outside speaker.
Yeah, so I get that. But one interesting thing to consider, especially if you have small children, I don't like wearing closed back headphones when I'm taking care of my young son, because some of them do a really good job of sealing out outside noise, even if they're not like active noise canceling headphones. And you might not hear something that you want to hear. You might not hear that crash or a child who needs your help or something. So I always feel kind of isolated from the family when I'm wearing them. If mom's home and I'm at the computer, they're great. And I have gaming headsets that seal out most outside noise. But during the day, especially, I tend to wear things that allow me to hear the world around me. And if you're out like taking a walk or something, who cares if there's a little sound leakage? If you want to take your nice headphones on a walk or something, it does allow you to hear if there's a car coming up behind you, that sort of thing. So it's safer not to wear, you know, headphones that close out the outside. But there are benefits. I personally don't like the pressure. There's a bit of pressure involved with closed back headphones, in my opinion, where sound pressure against your ears is more intense. Where open back, they obviously breathe more. They never have really the bass response. I like the particular sound signature of open back, though. They tend to sound, to me anyway, a little more natural. But maybe it's the open back headphones I use, because I have some Audio Technicas and Grados and stuff that are all open back that I like.
Right. Partially, I mean, the if you, you know, one of the challenges with open back headphones is in traditionally, they have given you a sort of a larger feeling soundstage. Traditionally, they also have not had a lot of sub bass compared to some of the closed back headphones. I don't find that closed back headphones press on me, but I also, you know, once you've been in a small concrete, you know, once you've seen one too many shows in a small concrete cinder block building, where the sound pressure levels were obscenely high. The sound pressure levels that I'm willing to turn up to on headphones don't seem nearly as onerous. It's something definitely worth trying. I mean, basically, you know, try on as many headphones as you can, listen to the music you like to listen to, find the one that makes you happy. I'd also like to give a shout out to JBL's Mark II 306P and 305P. Those are really good powered studio monitors for the money. If you have a chance to listen to these with your own ears before you buy, that's a good idea. Because it was funny, I found a Reddit article where somebody was savaging the choice of the Mackies over, say, the JBLs or some of the other studio monitors out there. You know, there are some really good speakers for not much money. And, you know, it's tough. I'm a real huge fan of what ELAC's done with the debut, especially the 2.0 and the UBHs. There's definitely some really, you know, it's tough because there's some really good speakers out there. And, you know, you can have two people, even with similar taste in music, listen to the same set of speakers, come up with radically different opinions on them. Or the same speaker positioned differently in a different room could sound really different. So I think you're moving in the right direction to all this stuff. You know, go forth, listen, and choose what you like best.
I have a very quick footnote on that, by the way. There's a really cool resource on YouTube. It's a channel called Digital Stereophony. I put a link next to that question in our show notes. But if you look at digital, it's spelled stereophony, like stereo and then phony. So if you search them out, they do side-by-side comparisons of computer speakers and active monitors. So, and they take requests. They've had a lot of people request certain very popular studio monitors or computer speakers, and they do ABs. And it's all done using the same. I'm looking at their rundown here. There's a Zoom H6 recorder. They're in a semi-treated room. They do frequency measurements with a calibrated microphone. They level match all of the recordings with an SPL meter, leave everything at neutral tone. So you, without having to buy and return speakers or demo speakers, you do get a fairly accurate feel of how it would sound in a room. And I actually picked out my last pair of speakers after watching a bunch of comparison videos here because it's the same thing. I wanted it just for an upstairs computer setup. I wanted a small set of computer speakers, and I haven't heard computer speakers in so long because, like Patrick, I've been on this road of using basically bookshelf speakers with an integrated amplifier for years now. So going back and actually buying computer speakers felt kind of weird. Like, the only computer speakers I owned were vintage ones, like really old Creative speakers, like passive Creative speakers that plugged into the speaker out of a Sound Blaster 2. So it's a pretty fascinating channel to just kind of scroll through and listen. Obviously, YouTube compression, everything does its thing. But
yeah, I was going to ask. I haven't
found a resource like it yet.
I mean, my issue with that is working backwards. What are you listening with? You know, what are you listening with? How is that impacting the sound? What is YouTube's compression doing the sound? Although it's not as bad as it was a few years ago. It's an interesting idea. You know, I like that they're doing the sound of frequency. Did they mention what they're using to measure the frequency response on that?
Just the microphone. They list the microphone they're using. I don't know about software.
So they just use the stock mic on a Zoom H6?
No.
No, they use the UMic 1. I see it now. Okay. Interesting. All right, I'll check that one out. I am fascinated.
They play I think, three different genres of music. So you have classical, you have jazz, you have pop, I think, for every speaker, and then they play the same clip. It gets kind of tedious, but you're listening to the same clip on, you know, one speaker, then the other speaker, you know, and it, you go back and forth and kind of decide. And it, you know, obviously the room plays a role.
Right.
When you're in a room, the loudspeaker kind of, it's the opposite of what I'm trying to say. The speaker.
The room may impact the loudspeaker as much as the design of the enclosure on the loudspeaker.
Thank you. That's so much more eloquent than the babble that's coming out of me. Yeah,
no, but it's a tough thing.
The room becomes a speaker.
Like, yeah, the room has a huge impact on the speaker. And moving the speaker, it is amazing what moving a speaker 6 inches or 12 inches can do to the sound of something, right? Because you're trying to, you know, the magic of stereo is that you have two speakers and that they can create this stereophonic image that has height and width, and you know, the singer or whatever is the center of it. The orchestra, the jazz group is in the direct center there, and it's pretty magical. And you know, shifting one of those speakers, changing them, having it's just there's a it's amazing what moving a speaker a little bit can do, and it's amazing how bad you can make a speaker sound. You know, the RVM inside of is like 90% hard surfaces, so this would be atrocious because it would, you know, you would have first order reflections coming from three different directions in a very small space, and I'm nerding out hard here. And if you want me to talk about this, email ask@avxl.com. No, email twitch@twit.tv, and Sebastian and I will talk about this. But it's amazing, like, you know, you can mess up the way a speaker sounds simply by moving it in a space where, you know, the room, it's a rat hole I can go down. It's less visual on desktop speakers.
Yeah, and then think about the fact that another problem is most desktop setups are up against the wall.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're even in a corner, which creates a horrible environment for a lot of speakers, especially considering you have a hard time finding a smaller bookshelf speaker that's not rear ported. And if you don't allow that rear port some extra breathing room, end up with a bad sound. It's like a 60 to 100 hertz chuffing sound of the air hitting the wall, and it creates bad
or simply
lower bass. And
the wall essentially, you know, elevates or amplifies you know, the low end sound coming out of the speaker. So that's one of the tricks with speakers. You have enough bass moving closer to the wall, and it works up to a certain point until you start hearing the chuffing noise of air moving in and out of the vent. Andrew Jones over at ELAC, one of the reasons they did the debut 2.0 is they brought the bass port to the front of the speaker, is in large part so people could get the speakers closer to the wall without issues. Also one of the things where if you have issues with that, moving like everything from, you know, 80 or 120 hertz down to a subwoofer can make a huge difference. Speakers in a corner are a nightmare. And if you'd like us to talk about that, email Twitch at twit.tv. And if you'd like us to talk about
speaker talk.
Yeah. We could do this all day, people. We want your questions, period. Whether you're looking at laptops or desktops or graphics cards, we're down for it. We're here for you. I'll be firing up my Magic headphones later and taking a listen to these. I'm fascinated by this website. Mostly because I can think of some of these speakers where I've heard, and I'm kind of curious how it will adhere to here. It's funny. There's a gigantic philosophical argument or metaphysical argument on whether you're really hearing the audio after it's been through all this. Because I also laugh because there's one particular audio reviewer I can think of who refuses to discuss speakers he's heard at trade shows for the most part because he believes he can't legitimately review them until they are in his listening space at his house. Which on one hand, there's a lot of logic there. And on the other hand, you know, there's been some speakers I've heard that sounded amazing, you know, in a hotel room in Las Vegas that sounded just as amazing when you got them home. But that's a whole nother another level of madness. It's hard to benchmark audio. Or at least it's hard to benchmark audio without like $30,000, $40,000 worth of tools.
True.
Again, conversation. PZPur.com is the website. You can find Sebastian Peake. He is the editor in chief. He makes the place produce the content. Anything you can tease about what's coming up there? Or are you pretty NDA'd within an inch of your life right now?
I don't know if it's because of all of the coronavirus and delays and canceled events, but it seems like this year has been quieter so far. I think by this time last year, I was under a couple of NDAs and working on a new GPU review or something, and things are pretty quiet on this front. So getting through the backlog, you know, just the usual stuff, motherboard reviews, which are incredibly time consuming and not rewarding.
Motherboard reviews are hard.
No, it's not fun.
They're rewarding. It's just you rarely, I guess it's not that it's not rewarding. It's just you rarely find a motherboard that particularly outperforms any other motherboard.
It's mostly about features and power delivery. Yeah. Which sounds boring, but it's like, does this have the features you want? Okay. It has all the headers you want. Okay. And how's the power delivery? What about the heatsink design? Adequate.
Right.
All right, good. Now look at price. So it's not real complicated. I mean, the chipset and the processor and the memory you use, that's where the performance is for the most part. And then it's all about heatsink design and that sort of thing. So it's very technical.
But hopefully they haven't screwed up the heatsink design.
That's been the big complaint, especially in the X570 era, for sure.
Really?
How loud is the Southbridge fan? How good are the heatsinks? Yeah.
Are they adequate?
Right.
That's what Rolls Royce
weighing them. You just take them off and weigh them. Like, well, this one weighs 14 grams more than that one, so we're going to assume that means better. More better. Also, I should spray paint them black and see if that helps.
No. That's a trade secret.
No.
Okay, we'll let that one loose. According to a reference made on a Wikipedia article about heat sinks, apparently heat sinks that have been spray painted or painted black, or I don't know if it's just paint or anodized. So assume basically the color black radiates heat better and therefore delivers like as much as an 8% boost in cooling performance. So I just can't. So Sebastian and I were discussing getting matching heat sinks and spray painting one of them black and then running cooler tests on them. Because one of the things we pointed out is so often at this point, especially on liquid coolers, you get to you're just flatlined on the performance. You can make a much cooler liquid cooling system, a much more visually stimulating liquid cooling system with a $1,500 water block / tubing / pump / special dye combination. But the thermals are probably almost exactly the same as a $100 or $200 sealed cooler, which is difficult or frustrating or, irritating. Help me out here, Sebastian.
Upsetting.
I'm flailing.
Yeah, upsetting, disconcerting.
Well, it's always nice when the $100 thing performs as well as the $500 thing.
Yeah, and the world of needing an all-in-one liquid cooler for high-performance CPU, as we've talked about extensively, big tower coolers are really good. And it's hilarious to me to go back in time, because I have a bit of vintage computer stuff laying around here, and look at what constituted a CPU cooler just a decade ago. Maybe, well, a little bit over a decade ago. Because a decade ago, the giant dual heat sink, the dual tower heat sink started to become more prevalent. We had the Thermalright Silver Arrow and the Noctua NHD14 right around 2010, I think. So since then, they have been outperforming all but the best all-in-one liquid coolers. So they're still definitely used for them. And they're for no other reason than the fact that they're easy to install and uninstall. Once you have that set up, popping off the all-in-one water block and pump is so much easier than taking a huge dual tower cooler off of a CPU. So
yes, there is that. There is that. Oh, my goodness. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. We like to call it Twitch. If you want information on how to subscribe, well, actually, you should just be able to search for This Week in Computer Hardware in your favorite podcatcher. But if you want links, people, head over to twit.tv/Twitch, and you'll find all of our older episodes, links to us, and links to subscribe on just about every platform on the planet, whether you want the audio or the video. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peake.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.